Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Taylor Mason.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to yet another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And I must say, very pleased to hear that many of you are downloading the show. And it was good to catch up with somebody who was asking when we're going to be back on air because he had a backlog of shows on his phone. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And it's good to catch up again, John. And as usual, plenty happening in the world of sport.
It never stops, does it? Oh, except for a few days around Christmas time. And Easter Friday.
Our special guest on this podcast will be Stacey Rosman, the coach of the West Coast Fever, and their season has just got off to a flying start, and Stacey Rosman has really slotted into that role of coach in superb form.
Well, she had a great season with the team last year, and no reason why she can't continue this year.
Absolutely not. Now, another female that's had a great career, and it was very sad to hear her announce her retirement, John, was Lauren Jackson, who at 34, her knees have said she cannot do this anymore.
You know, in a funny way, it shows you're getting old when you think, oh, wasn't that long ago Lauren started, was it? But then when you think this would have been her fifth Olympics and put her into very rarefied air if she had got there.
She made her debut at 16.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And so 18 years at the top in any sport, that's phenomenal.
Oh, yeah, I think just purely on the fact that she's not too many people get to go to one Olympics, let alone four. She's an amazing athlete, and good luck to her in the future.
I think one of the things that I was impressed with as well was the fact that you had Kobe Bryant and LeBron James coming out saying she is the greatest, and that when you have guys like that coming out and praising not only a female basketball but an Australian female basketballer, that's a massive, massive compliment.
I don't think they'll be saying it about Delhi though, which is a bit of a pity.
But no, it's really sad that the body has taken the... It's basically forced her out of it. I mean, she was saying it's almost like losing a loved one.
And when you consider the sport she's playing, she's probably succumbed to an injury that's not uncommon in that sport. It's probably killed a few injuries in that sport. So it's sad, but it's going to catch up with you and play as much as she does. Something's got to give sooner or later.
Now, another one that's popped up in the last week is the USA women's team, who have been saying they've lodged a federal injunction for a discrimination in terms of what they're paid compared to the men's team, in that they generated $20 million from their World Cup performances for the USA Soccer Federation, and they're saying they deserve a bigger cut of the pie. Now, I think we're seeing more and more of the female teams saying this, but as you've touched on, it's not quite as simple as that, because sport now is a business.
Absolutely. It is. It is business. And as soon as you start moving on from talking about the game, the actual sport aspect of it, and start talking business and what am I getting paid, then it's got to be handled in a business-like fashion, in a business-like manner. And you get paid according to the number of people that come through the turnstile or turn on the TV. Every sportsman is susceptible to that. Every sportsman is paid on how many people come through the gate or turn on their TVs.
We've talked about the wages in some of the sports and that the top athletes are getting. And I have to say, I think it is ridiculous, some of the numbers bandied around, especially with English Premier League footballers. Yeah. And you do wonder if the women don't have a point. I totally get your business argument, but I do wonder if sometimes if they actually trim that down a little bit, there could be a little bit more of the pie for the females. Because if you look at, again, in the Olympic Games, and again, we have to take into account that women's involvement in the Olympic Games has not been as long as the men's involvement. If you look at 1980, for example, in the sport you love, was when women's hockey was first introduced. That's not that long ago. It's 36 years ago. Yeah. So women's involvement in a lot of the sports at the Olympics, but their rate of improvement in their performances is far greater than the men's, because obviously the men's has been much slower because they've been involved and it's evolved over a certain time. And I think sports science has seen a lot of these women really go further. And I think if we look at, again, if you go back to the 1999 Women's Football World Cup and you compare it to the one that took place last year, the standard of the play, the standard of the players and their actual physical attributes has come on phenomenally, and you do feel that maybe they do have an argument because their game is improving. It is closing the gap on necessarily the men's performances.
And that may very well be true on the sporting field. You mentioned a figure there that the women claim that they generated $20 million for the American Football Association. Is that $20 million profit? Or is they just generated gross an amount of $20 million?
It was a figure that was apparently in the US Soccer Federation's annual report. So the federation were the ones who said that the performance of the women's team generated $20 million. Okay. I don't know how it was. I haven't seen the annual report. But that was where the figure came from.
Because in all fairness, $20 million isn't a great deal of money when you're talking international sport. And when you're talking about flying players around the globe, when you're talking about putting players up in hotels, when you're talking about getting meals for players, dietitians for players, physiotherapists, relationship counsellors, God knows what else goes on behind the closed doors, $20 million bucks doesn't go very far over even a one-year period for a really high-profile team. So it would be easy to say, oh yeah, we made $20 million, give us half. And sportsmen, all they see is the dollar sign. They don't really have an understanding of what's going on behind the scenes a lot of the time, because they're focused on football, which is what you want them being focused on. That's why they pay all these other people to be behind the scenes.
And you've hit the nail on the head there, because I know there's a sporting team here in Perth that are currently looking to try and go and play in Asia. But it's sort of hit a speed bump in that what they have asked is they want the hosting country's team to pay their accommodation, look at meals when they're on the ground, all of the costs when they get there. And now they've turned around and said, we also want you to pay our airfares. And the Asian federation or sporting body has turned around and said, well, no, if we're going to pay for everything when you get here, you can at least pay your own airfares. And again, you sort of think, who's being... I mean, I think the team from Australia is being greedy. I think if you're getting everything paid for you, and as you said, hotels and all of that, you know,
transport,
the least you can pay is an airfare. And airfares to Asia now are not too bad. And the guys may have to sit in economy. It's only a 5-hour flight, so surely they can put up with that.
Yeah, and it comes back to how much you generate too. I mean, I get the feeling that there's a few elite sports at the top of the television pile, and you're talking your English Premier League, your NFL, basketball, NBA basketball, and then everything else drip feeds off that. And huge amounts of money are generated in those three, probably four sports, would be another one, some ice hockey or baseball or something like that, that generate huge amounts of money. But then everything else undercuts what's available for everybody else. There's only a certain amount of money in the pie. And if three sports are getting 80% of it, well, everybody else has got to take what they can get. And that goes for the athletes as well. It's not just the administrators have got to consider that.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
It was interesting. I had a long chat with the former Australian, Netherlands and Malaysia hockey coach Terry Walsh, and he was saying he reckons the next 15 years, especially in Olympic sport, is going to be very, very interesting. Because he said, if you see the governments now, it is all about, we're only going to fund those teams that are successful, that bring us gold medals at Olympics, that get into the finals of regional or international competitions. They're withdrawing money from all of those other events and are not prepared to invest in someone like a weightlifter, where, you know, the weightlifting program, it takes about 8 years for a guy to get to the peak. And they're saying, we can't wait that long. And it's, again, that fast food society that we seem to be living in, where everybody wants success immediately.
And it's one of the downsides of this centralised funding model that we have here in Australian sport too, is that it only rewards success, but it doesn't breed success. It rewards it, but it doesn't do too much to get that success in the first place. And it's almost like the funding bodies are just waiting for that once-in-a-generation person to come along. And they're not actually trying to create a few others who might not be that world champion for 10 years, but they might be able to pinch a world championship along the way.
But this is where, and you know, we've had this discussion off air as well. I feel very strongly that if we're going to have an Australian Institute of Sport, and if the money at the top in sport is going to be as great as it is at the moment, there needs to be some sort of a hex fee that comes back. That if, like we saw when we interviewed the gentleman from the PGA, the golf in America, he was saying that once they earn over 200,000, they give, I think it's 2% of their earnings back to the PGA so that they can generate the next, bring through the next generation of golfers. And I think Australia needs to start looking at doing something like that. If you looked, I think it was the 2008 Olympic Games, the medals that we won cost $46 million each, I think it was, in a report that came out. Now, you know, you can't continually prop up that. There are other areas of the community that need that money really badly. But I think if we're going to see athletes that go on, and let's be honest, well, Harry Kuehl never went through the AIS, so he's a bad example. But if, say, he had, and his earnings were put at $15 million recently, surely he can give a percentage of that if he had come through the AIS. And if you think you're getting a child or a young player at 16, 17, 18, when if you throw in front of them and say, look, when you earn $250,000, we want you to just give us 2%, they're going to sign because they'll go, wow, if I'm earning $250,000 a year, I'd be pretty happy with that.
Yeah, I think Harry Kuehl was a bad example.
Oh, it is, because I could, yeah.
Not because he didn't go to the AIS.
No, he didn't, but okay, you got Mark Viduka, who did pretty well for himself. John Aloisi is another one who, again, had a good career in the UK. So there have been plenty of players that have gone through there and have made, you know, good money in their careers.
One of the failures of our system is you just mentioned there. The success was, it cost $46 million for one gold medal. Well, how do you, lies, damn lies in statistics. What does that mean? What does that actually mean? Does it take into account all of those other athletes who've been active in their communities? It's not just about the one and the one gold medal. Remember the whole idea of what the Olympics is about?
Well, this is, again, and that goes back to the point that I think the governments are missing the point of what the Olympics was about, and also the importance of sport, which is, as you say, encouraging people, being a role model. That if you meet someone like a Sutherland Scuds, who's a fencer, so a guy from Perth who has managed to fence at the highest level in the world, and he's just missed out on qualifying for Rio and has announced his international retirement, but here's a guy that has encouraged others to take up the sport because of what he's achieved. He's never won us an Olympic gold medal, but he's got people involved in the sport, he's got them being active, and there's these guys that we're forgetting about, and they need as much support as everybody else.
And we've got to take into account the changing nature of sport as well. I mean, in the 20th century, there were probably two big radical changes to sport and how it works with our community. First one was the invention of the electric light bulb, because suddenly you can play sport at night and games aren't having to be held while people are at work. They can be held when people are able to go to the matches. Second one was television. And television completely changed the sporting landscape in the second half of the 20th century. And now we're into a third phase, and that's social media. And so, not social media per se, but the rise of new technologies, internet TV, on your phone. You can watch a live sporting contest from the other side of the globe live on your 6-inch screen on your phone. That is incredible. But it's changed the whole landscape of the way sports are run.
It has. I mean, the interesting thing, I think, is you touch on there that there's now this move to go away from the phones with all that technology. There's a whole lot of people are going, it's just got too much, I'm using my phone too much, and they want to go back to your basic phone, which just has phones, text, and internet. That's all they want. And I must admit, I'm one of those people, I would love that. I think there's so many things on my phone, I don't use them. I wouldn't use 80% of it. But then I'm an old guy.
Well, I'm the opposite of you. When someone holds their phone up in front of my face and say, oh, have you seen this highlight from this game? I can't see that, mate. I want to see it on my big screen TV. That's why we created big screen TV, so we could watch this stuff and see it instead of squinting your eyes and trying to get the angle right so the sun doesn't glare and all sorts of rubbish.
We're just grumpy old men, let's face it.
The world is bad.
Hi, I'm JC Jand from West Coast Fever, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Everybody's bad. The girl is bad.
Well, as we said, our guest on this podcast is the coach of the West Coast Fever, Stacey Rosman. It was her first year in charge of the team last year in 2015, and they made the finals for the first time. She did an absolutely fantastic job. They've had a really good pre-season tournament, and everything augurs well for 2016. Of course, the pressure now is on Stacey to repeat that performance this year, and we caught up with her to see how she feels about the pressure and how the team are going to react to now being one of the teams to look out for. Stacey Rosman, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Yeah, great to be back.
Well, Stacey, first of all, congratulations on a first season in charge in the ANZ Championship. Was it beyond your wildest dreams what you achieved last year?
Yeah, I think at the moment it's setting in a little bit more because I guess when you're in the moment, you don't quite comprehend how hard it is to do what we actually achieved in a season, and looking back now and then also looking, starting our first game, it's certainly, a big task to get out there and be able to get the wins that, we replicated last year.
How much did being a player for the side and then being the assistant coach help you in your first season as a senior coach?
I think it did a lot in that I knew the players really well, and having been through those experiences and understanding how to balance training and life outside, and also just having that relationship with the players is probably the thing that has helped me the most in being able to get them to really engage in the program that I wanted to implement and get their buy-in so that they were driving the program forward.
Sometimes, though, being close to the players can work against you because, obviously some of the players may have played with you at some point and then you've obviously been the assistant coach. But was that a difficult thing to manage?
I guess in some ways the players are quite comfortable around me. So, the way in which we communicate, you do have to make sure that there's always that level of respect, and I think that's the part that I've probably always had with the players, having been a captain of the club and just been a senior player, obviously later in my career. We've always had that respect and we know where the line is, and I think being the way the club is, it's knowing when it's business and then also having that time where you can relax and actually enjoy the people for who they are and not just treating them as athletes.
I know Netball WA gave you a role in the development of the game within the state. How much has that helped you keep an eye on talent, but also give people now the belief that if they're good enough, they will get a chance with the Fever?
Yeah, I think we've really integrated our programs and aligned them to the way the Fever has wanted to play and what we're building towards. So, mixing in with the underage programs, one, they can see that my message is transparent across all of our teams, and it makes it really clear around the expectations that what is required to become a Fever athlete. And I guess if you look at our list at the moment, we do have a number of WA athletes in the team. So we're really trying to open up the doors and allow our younger generation to strive to want to be a Fever player and to play elite netball for WA.
I know we've been covering, obviously, the Fever, and it was the Orioles before that, and it certainly feels over all those years, which I think is about 10 years now, that this time it feels, though, that there is that connection, that the netball community is probably the most together it's been in that 10 years. Do you feel that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess, having a bit of success does bring everyone together. But I think for a team that hasn't had a long history of success, we've had, great support from the community. But I think the way in which the players and our team want to be the WA side and be really proud to represent all of those that are involved in netball in our state has helped. And it shows that the team's buying back or giving back to the community as much as they support us. So when you've got that two-way relationship, obviously their involvement and wanting to be around the team and support the team, there's always going to be greater buy-in.
I don't want to take anything away from your own personal achievements, but how important was it having a coach of the calibre of Norma Plummer come over here to the West, and how important were the foundations that she laid?
Yeah, obviously Norma has a huge amount of experience, and you know, she's coached at all levels. So the way in which she demanded, you know, a high level training environment, she wanted that professionalism as far as an off court team as well. Certainly put WA in a step in the right direction, and I think then you know, having seen what it was that the players reacted well to and still had to develop was something that I could continue to carry on with.
Yeah, I was going to say that probably helped you because she was sort of like the bad cop and then you could take the good bits and the bad bits.
Oh, she's certainly a hard taskmaster, and you know, everyone has their coaching styles and they certainly can bring out the best in a lot of players, and then also you have to be able to adapt your coaching style to make it well-rounded for those that learn differently. So I think that I've, you know, certainly seen one style as her style of coaching, but then with all the coaches that I've had across my playing career, I've been able to draw on those experiences as well.
Now, that's obviously the best way to go. Now, you made the finals last year, and of course, the crowds were fantastic. The good news is this year you're playing more games at Perth Arena.
Yeah, we've got two there, so, you know, it's a fantastic venue, and we've got to break that hoodoo of not having our first win there. So, you know, we talked about doing things for the first time last year, and certainly winning at the arena is high on the agenda. It's a fantastic facility, and it allows the whole WA community to be in the one place at the one time watching, you know, two teams in the best netball competition in the world.
Does it make any difference playing there as opposed to your normal home venue?
Obviously, it's a bigger venue, so it's a bit more spread out, whereas Challenge is really quite, or HBF Stadium is really quite compact, and the crowd is really around the court. So it is a little bit different, but, you know, where we want to go, and if you see the Wildcats and what they've done to that environment, you know, it's certainly something that we want to make it, that there's a real green zone there, and we make that the home of netball.
I ask that because I know when I've spoken to rugby players and they've had to play at Subiaco Oval, because the pitch isn't rectangular, they've found troubles with their angles in making passes and whatever, or kicks. Does it have an effect in that aspect, or is the sort of vision on the court not impaired at all?
No, I think, you know, netball's fortunate that it doesn't really matter where you play, is the dimensions of the court are exactly the same, and you know, the floorboards are generally pretty similar. So it's not like we have to deal with different, you know, size fields or different surfaces. So that's the part that we really embedded into the team last year, is that, you know, going away, once you deal with the travel and you put all those processes in place to adjust the time zones and things, at the end of the day, the court, the dimensions, the ball, everything's the same as if you're at home, and I think that helps the players deal with it a lot better.
Now, after last season, there's going to be expectation, and you probably made that expectation even greater with the performance in the pre-season tournament.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's amazing how perception around the team changes with, you know, one season, and I guess for us, we are looking for that sustained success, and to be able to do that, you have to keep taking steps in the right direction. I mean, everybody ultimately wants to win a premiership, and all teams are starting at the same starting point, at that starting line at the beginning of the season. It's really how quick you come out of the blocks, how quickly you adapt and adjust. And, you know, for us, we always talk about the foundation that we laid last year, and it's our responsibility to each other that we keep taking those steps and getting those gains towards a better performance and a better outcome. So, you know, our aim is finals and to win a final, and from there then, you know, you can address things as they go. So, yeah, certainly expectation, but it's something that we're really controlling, and it is in our control as to how we perform.
Just looking at that pre-season tournament, there were 3 points for shots from a certain region. Did you like that rule?
I mean, obviously it added something a little bit different to the game, and, you know, it challenged the shooters. I think we forget that they have the capability of shooting the long shot. I guess obviously putting an extra line in the circle really highlighted when they did do that. So, you know, it added a bit of spice to the pre-season, you know, but I'm still a fan of the traditional game. But I think, you know, there's time and place for when to change it up. And obviously there's also the Fast Five series, which is a different style of netball. So it's kind of like your rugby sevens type play as well. So, I think it was good for the girls. It challenges them differently. It challenges the way you coach, and you know it keeps things a bit fresh, particularly when you've been doing a pre-season for so long.
Certainly sounds like you're loving coaching.
Yeah, I do. And for me, I think coaching, I've always said, it's not really a job. It's a life experience. It shapes who I am as a person, and the friends and people that I've met along the way have really taking me to a new level in the way that I communicate, I engage with people, and you know, it is a lot of fun. It's not many people get to go to work and it's all about a game, so you got to keep things in perspective. But I can tell you, when we get to the courts on Saturday, it'll be that white line fever, and we'll definitely be stepping across and going for it.
I've got to ask you one question, though, Stacey. I mean, I've spoken to a lot of players that became coaches, and they say nothing beats playing. Do you feel that way still?
I think I've probably parted with my playing days. I still find it extremely hard during the warm-up. It's probably the toughest moment, because it's the time pretty much you give all the reins over to the players. They step across that line, and you pretty much... you're sitting there ready to give advice, but really they're the ones playing in the moment, and you've got to back that you've given them all the tools to be able to make those really good decisions under pressure. So the warm-up's the toughest, because you can't actually get out there and touch the ball, but I'm also very aware that with the way the game's been played, I'm well and truly past my playing days.
Well, great to catch up with you once again, and all the best to you and the West Coast Fever in the coming season.
Excellent. Thanks very much.
I'm Caitlin Bassett, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
And that was Stacey Rossman, coach of the West Coast Fever. I must admit, John, when I was talking to her there, it suddenly came back to me that we've been doing Not the Footy Show for 10 years. It'll be in September. And so we were talking to Perth Orioles and then at West Coast Fever. And we've been talking to Stacey throughout that whole period.
Yeah, she's a one-team girl, isn't she, Stacey? And good luck to them this season. Obviously, you know, people will be maybe asking questions. There was such a meteoric rise last year. Can they maintain it? Is there going to be a second year coaching blues or rah, rah, rah? But they seem to have hit the ground running. And they haven't been outlandish in their statements prior to the season starting. They've been very quiet about that. We're just here to, you know, improve on last year, blah, blah, blah. So they haven't been, you know, come and join us for our season, we're on fire and all that sort of stuff. So the players have been allowed to just concentrate on playing netball and not having these other extraneous issues forced on them.
Well, I must say I've got a lot of respect for her. I think she was a good captain, the way she handled herself as that and the way she's conducting herself as a coach. And when you think there are some players she played with as a player in that team, and that's always a difficult bridge to cross, but I think she's done a really good job.
She seems and comes across as very level-headed, very calm about things. We'll have to ask one of the players one day what a Stacey Rossman roast is like when she really bakes them. I wonder what that's like.
Absolutely. Now, just before we move on, I know last time we were having a chat, John, you asked me if I could find out whether the FFA drug test players in the FFA Cup.
Yeah.
Well, you wouldn't believe I've sent 3 emails to the FFA to ask what you would think would be a very simple question. I actually said, A, are they tested? B, if not, why not? And C, if not, are they going to be in the future? Fairly simple questions. The first one, I got no reply. The second email I sent to an individual who came back and said, it's not my job to answer that. Even though he works in the media department, you'd have thought he would have forwarded it and got a response for you. So I've gone to the Director of Communications, Carl Patterson, who assured me last week he would come back to me with an answer. I'm still waiting. So stay tuned and we will find out for you.
Just on that, it's not whether they get drug tests or not. I don't, you know, whether that FFA chooses to or chooses not to. What it's about is the playing conditions for the teams. And obviously, the A-League teams do get tested. The state teams, I would just want to know, are the playing conditions the same for both sides?
And in a competition where they're both playing, they should
exactly.
be.
Exactly. That's right.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
If they decided they weren't going to drug test them, that's fine. I've got no issue with that. I don't really care. But if there's one lot that are and one lot that aren't, that doesn't fit and doesn't gel.
Now, that probably leads us nicely into the whole Lucas Brown affair.
Oh.
And what a mess that is. Again, more embarrassment for the sport of boxing. My personal view is I cannot see why he would have possibly taken what he's been accused of taking. Because, well, he had everything to lose.
Exactly. I tend to believe him. In fact, I do believe him. I think he went there clean. And whatever he took, it's got into his system. Now, we've got to be careful here because the substance he is accused of having taken is legal and is used as a food supplement in the country that he's in. In fact, in Russia at all, full stop, they're allowed to use those substances in growth hormones and etc. For animals, so they can fatten them up and all that sort of stuff. So it's in the food chain. Those banned substances are in the food chain. Now I think it's about time that the whole anti-drug thing was rethought. I'm not saying we should just allow people to take drugs, but they've got to go back and rewrite the script because obviously someone who has A, no intention, and B, is totally against it, can get caught because they're just eating food. Regular, I mean, you can't. It's just staggering that this situation's allowed. How can you have a substance that's banned in one country but not banned in another country on a banned list?
Yeah, and the other thing I would say, if you look at his support staff, Nigel Benn, who's the former British middleweight champion, he was in his support staff. Nigel Benn was a bit of a Jack the Lad when he was younger, and you know, the sort of hero worship got to him, and he admitted that. And since then, he's become a born-again Christian. He does a lot of work in Redfern over in Sydney and New South Wales now to help the underprivileged there, and dedicates his life to doing things like that. So he is absolutely 100% about doing things properly, above board, and being a pillar in the community. So I think knowing his background, there is no way that he would condone one of his fighters taking anything that was illegal. So to me, I think poor Lucas Brown has been set up. He said he knew that there were the risks going over there to fight, and it looks like they've come back to haunt him. Hopefully, he will be exonerated.
Well, and if he's got this test result from the 5 days before he went there, I mean, that should say a lot about...
Exactly.
...about what the situation is. I mean, it's interesting, too, because we've seen since... in the last few months, a proliferation of drug tests or stories you see in the media. And the drugs of choice now are very much therapeutic drugs. They're not necessarily drugs that are being developed for performance enhancing. They're actually drugs that no one's ever considered would be used as performance enhancers. But now the chemists are starting to go through the back catalogue a little bit. And they're starting to look at some of those drugs. Oh, so asthma people take that to help the, oh, well, we can give it to people without asthma and that will do the same thing to them and those sorts of stuff. So now we're getting to a stage where, you know, people are coming up with these fake asthmatic stuff. And I mean, Maria Sharapova was not asthmatic. So why was she taking an asthma drug for, oh, because I was getting anxious and stuff. Well, you don't take an asthma drug for anxiety. And what happened in the MMA? The MMA had guys test, all these athletes come to them, getting exemptions for testosterone. And finally, the MMA people went, hang on a sec, not 50% of our fighters have a low testosterone count. That's not what's going on, you know. We've got to ban these drugs. Medical exemption.
It was a lot better when they just survived on booze and fags.
Well, that's my
choice. Although I'm not condoning smoking. Okay, we have to be very careful that we don't condone smoking. But
not at all. Only as a training.
Latter-day athlete was quite keen of one, and many had one at halftime.
Well, even some modern athletes are known to sneak one in the back room.
Yeah. I mean, Felix, the goalkeeper in 1970 in that memorable Brazil team, the bench would actually light a cigarette for him before he left the pitch. So that was their duty. As he walked off, they would pass him a lit cigarette before he got to the changing room.
You've got to make sure your lungs are working. That's my theory.
Hi, this is Ian Healy, and you're listening to This Is Not The Footy Show.
Okay, well, we're coming towards the end of another podcast, but I just wanted to touch on the fact that Peter Hug, the CEO of Football West, has resigned, and he is heading over to head up Football New South Wales. Now, my big thing here, John, is what are the board going to be looking for in a new CEO? Peter Hug was the third CEO of Football West, and I think it was founded 2003 or maybe 2004. And we had Michelle Phillips, we've had Gary Chandler, and now Peter Hug. And Luke Martin was in an acting role when they were looking for Peter Hug. Now, Michelle Phillips was an FFA appointee. And, of course, when they took over Perth Glory, they moved her across to there. Gary Chandler came in. And I think Gary, by his own admission, would say he was a fairly shy guy. He was certainly not a very visible CEO in terms of the football community. Peter Hug has been a different person to Gary Chandler in that he has certainly been more visible, although he tends to be visible in the VIP areas at grounds rather than actually out there. And I'm serious about this. My view is I think we need a CEO that doesn't sit in a VIP area, that actually talks to the punters in the game. There's a lot of people very upset with the direction in which football is heading in Western Australia. Again, it goes back to they're seeing the money that's in the game, they're seeing the A-League on the TV, they want to see the next tier and the juniors getting money, getting profile and all of that. And I just think it needs a figurehead now, if it's going to go to that next stage, who is prepared to engage the people. Now, Peter Hug has said he engaged the people. He would sit there, but he wouldn't listen. And I know from having had meetings with him, he had his agenda, and often it was an agenda that was pushed by the FFA, and he was basically told, and a board member told me this, with the NPL, David Gallop said, I don't care how you do it, make sure it happens. Now, if that's coming from the FFA, yes, it's very difficult to blame the CEO for something like that if he's getting those instructions from his ultimate employer, but I think there needs to be far more engagement and far more listening. And also, I think less of the standover tactics. Obviously, with the NPL, that was the direction given from above with the FFA, and they had to make it happen. And there was a lot of people were pushed into corners and were forced to go down a path that necessarily, I still don't think the game was ready for it at that point in time. But as we all know, it was to satisfy a promise made by the FFA up in Asia that we would have a second tier competition to the A-League by 2013. Now, you know, I wish Peter Hug good luck, but I think we've got to look at the future. What does the game need now? Does it need another bureaucratic administrator, or does it need someone that's more out there, more visible, and is more of a sort of touchy-feely touch point for people in the game?
Well, I think that disconnect you talk about between the soccer public and the administration was no more evident than in the recent article in the West Australian over the cost of what it costs to get you signed up to a junior sport. So you want to sign your kiddies up, and there was comparisons between football and basketball, netball and soccer. For the sake of this conversation, I'll call it soccer, okay? And what I thought was Peter Hug's comments were totally out of step with the reality of the situation. I mean, he claimed that, you can sign your kid up for $100. Well, you can't. You can't. You just can't. And they quoted two parents in the story immediately after that who said it cost me $850 to sign one kid up for football for a season. And that's just ludicrous for a child. That is an outrageous amount of money.
Well, I can tell you, I know two of my friends who have two children, and they have taken those two children out of football because of the cost. Because there's no discount if you have two children playing the game. Now, again, if you want to charge high rates, you have to have some compensation to keep those children involved. And that's why I find it interesting that in the annual report, they claim that they've got more people playing the game than ever at 42,000 registered players. Yet I know people that are dropping out of the game. And if, in fact, if you look at it, the percentage growth is actually pretty poor against the growth of population that came into Western Australia in the last year. So everyone's saying it's great, but actually if you look at the growth of WA and the growth of the game, it's actually not that great. But I just think there are people dropping out because of those costs, and they're going to play at lesser clubs. So it's a crazy one, isn't it? And football was always a game for the man on the street, because it was such a simple game. You could put two jumpers down. You could make a ball out of rolled up socks or whatever, and you could play it. It was a game for everybody. Now it's being made into an elitist sport. And for someone that used to play in the park and play 18 a side with some jumpers as goals, I find that really, really sad.
Association football administrators have always, and other sports administrators have cottoned onto it, seen juniors as cash cows. That's what they see it as. They see, we'll rake in all the money and then we can go and spend it on other things, instead of seeing the juniors as the future cash cows. Don't worry about charging a kid $800 or his parents. Charge him $150 and develop in that child a lifelong love of the game. When you develop that lifelong love at that age, when they get to 22 and 23 and 27 and 29 and 45 and they're still playing the game and then they're working and they have their own wallets to dip into, that's when the money comes. That's where you're going to get the money from, because you can't keep dragging it out of parents. Eventually, as your friends, they stop paying. It gets too much for them. Develop the milk, and you'll get the cream. That's always a story. The more milk you have, the more cream you get. And the problem is these players who drop out from juniors and don't continue to be involved in the game, because they're using their wallets to buy other stuff and not using it to invest in football or whatever your sport has to be.
And if you look, and you touched on something there, a lot of the parents who are paying this money, they all want to see their little Jimmy being the next Wayne Rooney or the next Luis Garcia or, you know, whatever. They believe that their kid has the talent. And again, this may be harsh, but I was actually talking to a coach from overseas who took a team to Sydney and played against one of their academy sides over there. And he was appalled because he was saying how the coach at this academy, he heard him telling these parents how talented the children were. Now, these parents are paying big money to this academy, and he was saying he's taking these children across to the UK, this coach in Sydney, and they're paying about $6,000 for little Jimmy or Johnny or whatever to go to the UK to have these games. And he goes, the coach is raking in all this money. He goes, I can tell you, having come from the UK, none of those players would get a game in a Football League junior side. They weren't good enough. And he was appalled that there was this much money being thrown and there were so many, I suppose, untruths is probably the best way to put it, because they're hyping up kids who aren't good enough and telling the parents that they are, so that that money continues to come in.
Which neatly brings us back to the CEO position. You say 2003 Football West?
It was something around that, I think.
So
it was.
It's 2003, 2004. 13, 14 years it's been running,
yep.
12, 13. Home of football.
For those of you who can't see me, my eyebrows just raised. Look, I don't see that it's something that the game needs. I'm sorry, people can shoot me down. That's my opinion. I would rather see the money. They're asking for $20 million to build a home of football centrally in Perth, which at the moment we all know it's going to be at Ashfield Soccer Club, where they're in that area there. Now, I just don't see the point in it. I would rather see $20 million to upgrade the facilities throughout the metro area. Let's go from Yanchep or beyond all the way down to Mandurah. Let's make all the places where people play football better surfaces, better club rooms. Use that $20 million throughout that area is my idea. Or let's invest it in junior development, so that actually, as you say, we can build a foundation for the future by encouraging all those young players to fall in love with the game and stick with it.
Now, Ashley, I've managed to make a chart here which graphs the history of the home of football here at WA from that 2003 odd starting point.
I think 2013 was when they started pushing for the Home of Football.
Oh, was it?
Yeah. So the Home of Football came in around 2013.
Because we've got the start. It goes up very significantly where they mention the fact that they want to have a Home of Football. And then it goes along and the government gives them some money. And the graph goes down a little bit. And then they go along a bit more and the government gives them some more money and the graph goes down a little bit. And currently my graph shows activity for the Home of Football on zero.
Well, I think there's been a lot of talk and a lot of negotiations. And look, I think Ashfield as a club, they're very well run, knowing their committee and their president. And I think, again, they need to know if they're going to get into bed with Football West and possibly have Perth Glory as a tenant, that both of those organisations are run properly, because they're going to get caught in the net if anyone tries to take any shortcuts. And, you know, they can't put their club's history and all their club's members at risk by someone trying to take a shortcut. I'm not saying that Football West or Perth Glory are going to take a shortcut, but
Perth Glory have anything to do with this whatsoever?
Pardon?
Why does Perth Glory
have anything
to do with
it? Perth Glory is going to be a tenant, so they will be paying rent.
Good. You go and sit in the corner there, and when we've built it, you can come and chat to us then. But this has got nothing to do with Perth Glory. This is the home of WA football, not the home of Tony Sage's football team.
I agree with you on that one as well, I have to say. But they have been involved, I think, since the beginning and asked what their requirements would be. But to me, if they are moving in, you charge them the rent. And, you know, as the main tenant, they would be charging a high rent.
And how would the Glory's requirements be that much different from the ideal touted as being the home of football?
Well, because they train pretty much every day or for 9 months of the year, don't they?
So they would use the facility. Oh, so actually what you're building is a home ground for the Perth Glory. You're not actually building a home of football. Come on, let's call a spade here. We always do that. You're building them a home ground.
Well, they won't play their games there.
But they'll spend every other bloody day there, won't they?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And, I mean, they'll have a canteen there. It'll be a proper...
Yeah.
But that's why if they're going to move in, they are your highest paying tenant.
So that's why, you know, Billy's dad out in the back boons at Forresto, he's got his kid paying $800 a year, looks at it and goes, this isn't really a good idea.
Yeah, and that's where you see, again, this is one of the things I'm against it. So you're going to have a private enterprise that will benefit the most from such an establishment.
From community funding.
Yeah, and that's where I have a real problem with it.
Why doesn't the Perth Glory supporters and the club itself get together and build their own training base? That's what it is about private ownership. In case Mr. Sage hasn't noticed, that's what private ownership means. You privately pay for it, buddy. And this idea of the government and the community should be responsible is rubbish.
Well, I can't understand after, was it the Glory were accused of not paying $250,000 on the transport deal they had with the tickets when there was free travel on that. I wouldn't be putting any money into Perth Glory Football Club as a government until that money was paid back.
Fair enough, too.
But we know the governments don't work like that.
No.
Anyway, that's probably enough for us on this podcast. We will be back with another one very soon. We do hope you enjoy it. Coming up soon will be an interview with the CEO or general manager of the Perth Wildcats, Nick Marvin. So stay tuned. But from us, it's goodbye.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is.
See ya. We'll be back next week.